En continuant après donc la première session qui était sur les études juives et l'interdisciplinarité, et je remercie Nitzan Leibovitch pour une conférence absolument extraordinaire et pour les discutants Perrine Simon-Nahon et Dominique Bourrel qui ont aussi contribué en très belle séance. Nous avons donc quatre séances cet après-midi. La première portera sur la question de la périodisation, donc études juives, histoire générale, la question de la périodisation. Et je vais passer en anglais parce que cette séance se déroulera, pardon, en anglais. I present our host, Michael K. Silber, from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He is senior lecturer in Austrian. He was a senior lecturer in Austrian studies in the Department of Jewish History and Contemporary Jewry at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and his researches focus on the Jews of Central Europe, Hungary, the Habsburg Empire in particular, from the end of the 17th century until World War I. He has written on a variety of topics, in particular on enlightening absolutism, on Jewish military service, on Orthodox Judaism, etc. I shall just mention a couple of his publications. A book, Jews in the Hungarian Economy, published in 1992, and his most one of his most recently recent contribution to the Cambridge History of Judaism, his chapter on the making of Habsburg Jewry in the long 18th century, that was published in 2018, and today he is going to propose us some reflections, some thoughts on early modern Europe and periodization of Jewish history. Thank you very much for having accepted our invitation. Mikhail, the stage is yours.
Thank you, David, and thank you for and Matthias, thank you for inviting me to this conference in the honor of Sylviane Goldberg, who has been a companion for the last 40 years in our search for various paths in Jewish history. So, recalling the title of the lecture is very vague because I think it gives me room for talking about almost anything. But it also, I think, it allows for a larger sort of discussion. So the title is "Some Thoughts on the Periodization of Early Modern Period in Jewish History." Recalling how he came to coin the term early modern, J.H. Eliot, J.H. Eliot, the great historian, noted, quote, "All attempts at historical periodization are by nature unsatisfactory because no single term can hope to encapsulate the character of an epoch as a whole. Early modern is similarly inadequate and runs the risk of suggesting that the period is no more than a staging post on the road to contemporary society. But no better term has yet been found for a period of 3 to 4 centuries in which the medieval and the modern interact in a fascinating combination," unquote. In advocating for the distinctiveness of these pre-Enlightenment centuries, Eliot was undoubtedly aware that by choosing early modern over late medieval, he risked emphasizing what was new, what seemed to adumbrate the modern, while downplaying continuities with earlier periods. I tend to view periodization as a useful tool of analysis in interpreting historical phenomena, a way of sharpening meaningful distinctions. For instance, the historiographical debate that arose some 60 years ago in defining the onset of modernity in Jewish society between the model proposed by Jacob Katz in his Tradition in Crisis, analyzing the transition between what he called the late medieval period to the modern era, And Azriel Shochatz, in his Im Chilufei Tkufot, in the Passage of Ages, who focused on the 18th century German Jewry, the acknowledged vanguard on the path to Jewish modernity. This debate has become a sort of a classic way of a springboard for discussion. Katz presented two views of Ashkenazi Jewish society, juxtaposing a snapshot of before and after, his analytic schema being based on underlying shifts of Weberian sources of authority from traditional to reason and charisma, providing the basis for ideologies that found institutionalization in the Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment, on the one hand, and the Hasidic movement on the other. The crisis of traditional Jewish society was brought on by the new ideologies. His mode of analysis was not far from Thomas Kuhn's paradigms, that is, a structural analysis that posited a frame which endowed meaning to social and cultural change. Shochat, and consequently many who followed, preferred, to my mind, rather simplistic social historical analysis, eschewing the notion that ideologies informed actions, posing an incremental model, one that gradually eroded traditional norms and institutions until, behold, one day arriving at full-blown modernity. There was little attempt to interpret the meaning of social and cultural actions, which for the most part were presented as self-understood. Thus, Shochat's chapters noted the lack of religious observance, acculturation to the norms surrounding society, interest in scientific knowledge, etc. All these divergences from traditional Jewish society, according to Shochat, preceded by decades the Haskalah, hence not ideology, but rather gradual erosion, brought about the transition to modernity. Early critiques of Shochat noted that traditional society was actually flexible enough to contain and tolerate the trends he cited without engendering a crisis, and should be interpreted not as harbingers of modernity, but rather as acceptable within the framework of early modern or late medieval period. And I'll bring just one example before I turn to two phenomena that I propose belong squarely within the framework of these centuries, not before and not later. Of late, I've been working on the history of the Jewish beard, hoping to add to insights pioneered by the late Eliot Horowitz. Now, the Jewish beard, or the lack of it, has been cited all too often as proof of either pious acceptance or rejection of Jewish norms, misinterpreted by even our leading historians. So now I'm going to take them on, okay? A good example is the cover of Shmuel Feiner's The Origins of Jewish Secularization in 18th Century Europe. Okay, look at the cover. It has the four sons of the Haggadah, and we're supposed to see this as sort of emblematic of the process of secularization. While Feiner does not explain why he chose this for the cover, David Beale, the late David Beale, in reviewing the book, clearly thought the illustration captured the essence of the book. Quote, "One early indication of these new behaviors of religious laxity and secularization is in Joseph ben David Leibniz's 1738 Passover Haggadah, in which the wicked son is portrayed clean-shaven in an elegant 18th-century suit with a powdered wig. The wise son, by contrast, is bearded and dressed like a traditional Jew." Unquote. So, can you see this? Is it this is the wicked son, obviously. All right? And he's supposed to obviously recall the whole idea of secularization. Before we examine the portrayal of the four sons, we have to ask, how would Feiner and Beale then interpret the illustration accompanying the Havdalah service in the very same Haggadah, with the secularization they view being indicated by, quote, they think that fashionable dress that breached religious restrictions, men's shaved beards and sidelocks, married women's uncovered heads, women in low-cut dresses. How would they explain this? I mean, here you have the very same sort of outward expressions of what they think is secularization, but the man and the women are taking part in the Havdalah service. So what makes the wicked son wicked? The wig, the clothing, the clean-shaven face? Clearly not if the Havdalah service is any indication. Anyone have an idea what makes them, what makes this, why is the wicked son wicked?
The sword.
Yes, but what makes the sword? Why the sword? You're right, it's the sword. But why the sword? The sword, because the sword, the answer is it's a sword, which marks him as a soldier. Since the Middle Ages, the wicked son has been represented as a soldier, and in this convention was reproduced in the printed Amsterdam Haggadah of 1695, whose plates served as models of the illustrated Haggadot of the 18th century. So what you have over here is at times the soldier, and you can see this in an illustrated, these are illustrated Haggadot, they're not printed ones, but you can see it's mimicking the printed one. But at times the soldier is in contemporary uniform. At times he is fancifully drawn, but always identifiable by the arms he carries. And because Jews were not associated with the military during these centuries, the wicked son was never really perceived as Jewish until modern times. So clearly then this was an egregious misinterpretation of an illustration by two outstanding historians. Well, now that I've gotten out of my head, that's it. So now, let us engage in a brief thought experiment. Rather than referring to the three centuries between 1500 and 1800, the early modern period, let us instead follow Jacob Katz in calling them the late medieval period. This shift in terminology serves as a reminder to view the historical phenomena not merely as precursors to modernity, but as integral components of a transitional era. While many historians of this period seek signs of increasing integration, I will focus on two distinctive phenomena whose tendencies are insular, diverging rather than converging with the non-Jewish environment. However, I will not be looking for continuities from the medieval period. Rather, I will emphasize the novel dimension of these two phenomena as they came to attain particular salience in this period, and to a certain degree will tend to decline with the onset of modernity. So I'm looking at two phenomena that are squarely early modern, begins there and more or less ends there, and both of them being novel phenomena. The first of these is the rise of the Kabbalah during these centuries, not just in growing popularization and impact on religious practice, as is well known, but its emergence as a body of knowledge that purports to possess soteriological significance, challenging previously accepted frameworks. The second development is the emergence of Jewish languages, Yiddish and Ladino, an innovation that increasingly diverged from the languages Jews spoke before the 16th century, and which contributed to their growing separation from the non-Jewish environment over the next three centuries. What follows is inspired by Sylvianus Goldberg, pioneering and often daring inquiries into the early modern Jewish history. So, Kabbalah and soteriology. So first, Kabbalah. Several features of this area are analyzed by David Ruderman's fine survey, early modern Jewry, mobility, impact of the print, knowledge explosion, rabbinic authority, the tensions around Kabbalah, are embodied in the figure of Yosef Karo, 1488 to 1575, one of the leading rabbis, if not the leading halakhic authority of his time. Born in Spain, exiled as a child to Portugal, then growing up in the Ottoman Balkans, he finally settled in Sfat in the Galilee, where he composed the Shulchan Aruch, Code of the Jewish Law, authoritative to this day. Imbuing the spiritual environment of Sfat with its cluster of great mystics, he immersed himself in the study of Kabbalah and recorded the visitations of a heavenly mentor, a Magid, in his secret diary. Karo's Magid was but one of a plethora of magical practices and experiences to emerge at that time that came to characterize the early modern era. And all of these phenomena, celestial maggids, harmful demons, spiritual possession by Dybbuks, xenoglossia, exorcism, mystical seizures in the form of epileptic fits, female prophets, heavenly visits in a coma-like state, the Hinebet, Baalei Shem healers, seemed to disappear around the end of the 18th century. Writing in the 1790s in Galicia, Dov Ber Birkenthal of Bolochov recalled, quote, "I saw with my own eyes in my youth several of our people who were possessed by spirits. They would throw themselves down in front of synagogues, pounding their chests cruelly with large rocks," unquote. But in these recent decades, quote, "no one has heard of harm coming from demons. The demons have fled entirely from these lands," unquote. These impressions were confirmed by his younger contemporary, Dov Ber of Linitz, the author of Tales of the Founder of Hasidism, Shivchei Abesht, Praise of the Baal Shem Tov, first published in 1814. In his introduction, he explains that his motive for writing the book was to evoke a magical world that has since faded into the past. Unquote. "I have noticed that in the times between my youth and my old age, every day miracles have become fewer and marvels have begun to disappear. This happens because of our many sins. In earlier days, when people revived after lying in a coma close to death, they used to tell about the awesome things they had seen in the upper world. There were also mad people who injured themselves with stones." During the reading of the Torah, "who used to reveal people's sins to them and to tell them which of their sins would cause their soul to wander restlessly. Because of all these things, many repented, and faith in the heart of each Jew was strengthened. Therefore, I was careful to write down all the awesome things that I heard from truthful people." That is all in the past. Just as the enthusiasm for Kabbalah often diminished the role of Talmudic study, so did the codification of the Jewish law. After all, why engage in the complex and time-consuming back and forth of Talmudic discourse when a legal code succinctly presents the halachic bottom line? Both legal codification and divine speculation, albeit in the Middle Ages in the form of philosophy, are closely associated with Maimonides, who openly favored reducing the role of Talmudic study for the mature mind, hence his Mishnah Torah, which was his code. He viewed metaphysical inquiry as the true path of perfection and the key to the soul's immortality. Nevertheless, Caro, the Kabbalist and the codifier, vehemently opposed attributing soteriological significance to any field of study other than the Talmud. Maimonides had scandalized many by redefining the ancient esoteric disciplines of Maaseh Merkava, the account of the chariot, and Maaseh Bereshit, account of creation, as metaphysics and physics, respectively. Maimonides further provoked outrage in his Laws of the Foundations of the Torah by dismissing Talmudic study as dealing with, quote, "matters that sages called small, for they said a great matter, davar gadol, is the work of the chariot, maaseh merkava, and a minor matter, davar katan, is the discussions of Abaye and Rava," unquote. Karo's Kesef Mishnah, a comprehensive commentary on Mishnah Torah first published in Venice in 1574, responds to this passage with palpable fury. He invokes the harsh critics of earlier masters, quote, "the Rambam wrote what he wished, and it would have been better had he not been written," or as the Ritva had concluded, "but in truth, the Talmud is the greater than all the wisdoms of the world," unquote. Rejecting alternative interpretations, Caro provingly cites Eliyahu Mizrahi, who acknowledges that while the study of the divine delves into subjects far loftier than the often intricate Talmudic debates, sometimes concerning matters that they may seem very trivial, or even unseemly, kinim upitre nida. It does not surpass Talmudic study in the greatness of reward, for it is through Talmudic wisdom, Caro insists, unquote, that one attains life in the world to come more than through any other wisdom, unquote. So Caro's intervention was hardly novel. By his time, the debate over the primacy of Talmudic study had spanned nearly half a millennium, dating back to Bachya ibn Pekudei's concerns. From the 12th to the 14th century, thinkers from Maimonides to Gersonides championed philosophy as a discipline that could serve as a soteriological bridge to transcendence. By the 15th century, however, even those engaged in philosophical speculation had largely abandoned such claims. This is prior to Chizdai Kreskast. The same was true for the most part of medieval Kabbalists, who maintained a firm grip on the esoteric element of knowledge, wary of the perceived dangers of the Kabbalah. But Caro stood on the brink of change. With the rise of print and the publication of the classics of the Spanish Kabbalah, followed by the novel works of the 16th century and the Lurianic corpus in the following, the dominance of Talmudic study faced an unprecedented challenge from Kabbalah. While the challenge of philosophy had been contained in the medieval period by a consensus that included the philosophers, reserving access to a esoteric cognoscenti, in the early modern period, Kabbalah now posed a direct challenge to the centrality of Talmudic scholarship by granting unrestrained access to a broader public. Just 4 years before the publication of Caro's Kesef Mishneh, Moses Isserles, the Rama, who challenged and amended Caro's Sfardi-oriented Shulchan Aruch, issued a sharp critique of the growing popularization of Kabbalah in his Torat HaOlah in 1570. So we're talking around the same decade. Quote, "Indeed, many among the common people rush to study Kabbalah because it is alluring, particularly due to the authors of recent generations who have revealed its secrets explicitly in their books. This is even more true in our time when Kabbalistic works such as the Zohar, Rekanati, Gates of Light have been printed, making their contents readily accessible to anyone who chooses to peruse them. Everything is laid bare to those who take a peek. Never mind that their words cannot be properly understood by anyone who has not received the tradition from a master Kabbalist. It is not only those with some book learning who delve into these texts, but even simple householders who cannot tell their right hand from left, who struggle to explain the weekly portion with Rashi, are now eagerly jumping on the bandwagon to study Kabbalah," unquote. This trend reached its peak in mid-18th century. Alarmed by the widespread popularization of Kabbalah and its occasional heretical implications, rabbinic authorities issued a ban in Brody in 1756. Quote, "We deem it necessary to impose restrictions and establish order regarding those who abandon the study of the Talmud and legal codifiers, seeking instead to penetrate the deepest secrets of the Torah without first mastering its plain meaning or attaining a proper understanding of the Gemara. Therefore, we decree that no one may study these writings, even those unquestionably authored by the Arim, because there was a problem whether these were forged manuscripts. It is strictly forbidden to engage in their study, Kabbalah, until one has reached the age of 40, unquote. But it was not merely popularization of Kabbalah that proved troubling. As Kabbalistic teachings permeated every sphere of religious life, a growing belief emerged that knowledge and study of Kabbalah were essential for the soul's salvation. This conviction was succinctly expressed in the last will and testament of Rab Leib Oppenheim, the rabbi of Galgotz in Hungary, penned as late as 1770. While he emphasized the importance of Talmudic study, he also urged the necessity of dedicating time to Kabbalah, the hidden teachings of the Torah. Quote, "For whoever does not perceive these secrets in this world will not merit to behold the hidden light prepared for the righteous in their eternal world to come, nor will they enter the divine precincts of the Holy One." Unquote. This was exactly the position that Ezekiel Landau, the rabbi of Prague and the foremost halachic authority of his time, vigorously opposed. More than anyone else, he most embodied the retreat from Kabbalah, rejecting its claims of being essential for salvation. His views were very well known through his published works and were often ascribed to the accusations that the Kabbalah had been tainted by Sabbatian heresy. But while Landau had strong grounds to oppose Kabbalah due to its associations with Sabbatianism, a recently discovered, censored, and unpublished section of a key sermon delivered in the autumn of 1770, that is the same year as Oppenheim's will, leaves no doubt that his condemnation was not merely for its Sabbatian misuse, but he rejected Kabbalah itself. If Sabbatianism, with its ma'aminim, believers, and its emphasis on credo, can be understood as a form of confessionalization within Judaism, by the way, a topic that's surprisingly absent from Rudiman's survey, then Landau's countermove, which sought to mute religious speculation by emphasizing the sufficiency of practice, can be seen as a form of deconfessionalization, something that interestingly its approach coincided with Moses Mendelssohn's similar emphasis on ritual observance and the de-dogmatization of Judaism. If the rise of Kabbalah's pervasive influence is a defining characteristic of the Jewish early modern period, then its rapid decline signals the era's end. When a German synod convened in 1836 to consider the question, quote, "Is Kabbalah deemed tradition?" unquote, the majority decisively voted, affirming that it held no binding authority. Quote, "On this occasion, it was noted that the High Court in Prague," that's where Ezekiel Landau had been the rabbi, "had explicitly declared that no one should consult the Kabbalah," unquote. But the decline of Kabbalah was noticeable not only in Central Europe, but also in the East, in Eastern Europe, with the rise of Hasidism. True, a generation after Landau, some young scholars affiliated with the growing Hasidic movement in Galicia, such as Ezekiel Panit and Tzvi Elimelech of Dinov, lamented the neglect of Kabbalah and sought to restore it to its rightful place, while blaming authorities like Landau for the deteriorating state of Judaism. But the damage was done. The retreat among Lithuanian mitnagdim was nearly total, while even most Hasidim in the 19th century, with few exceptions, came to neglect the study of the Kabbalah. This shift was not only in favor of some new texts such as the Tanya of the Chabad Hasidim. The soteriological focus moved away from Kabbalah study, instead embracing the mediation of a charismatic tzaddikim as a new salvific bridge to transcendence. A compelling example of this dynamic is the response of the young Ezekiel Panit sent to his concerned father, who disapproved of his association with the Galician tzaddik Menachem Mendel of Rimanov. His father had challenged the tzaddik to solve a complex problem, suggesting that only by proving his scholarly prowess in the Talmud could he earn his esteem as scholar and saint. In a remarkable letter penned in 1805 at the age of 22, Panit articulated a profound perspective on the nature of saintliness and scholarship. This document stands as a unique testament to the appeal that Hasidism held even for exceptionally gifted Talmudic scholars. Panit went on to becoming the chief rabbi of Transylvania and later on to be my ancestor. But it's deriding his father's objections, Panit dismissed the notion that Talmudic expertise alone defined true piety. He questioned the relevance of testing the tzaddik's mastery of intricate legal minutiae, writing, "What does one have to do with the other? Since when is one who can analyze fine distinctions and solve difficult problems considered a saint? Already, as it has been said," end quote, A great matter, Davar Gadol, is the account of the chariot, Maaseh Merkava. A trivial matter, Davar Katan, is the disputes of Abaye and Rava, unquote. Where, he says, where in the entire Torah do we find a commandment to be a razor-sharp scholar, unquote. At the dawn of the modern era, give me four. At the dawn of the early modern era, Caro rejected the sociological significance that Maimonides had attributed to philosophy, instead extolling the virtues of the Talmud, the insignificant thing, the give and take of Abaye and Rava. Perhaps he foresaw, that is, Caro foresaw, that a true challenge to the Talmud would come not from philosophy, but from the rapidly rising popularity of Kabbalah. But despite the growing dominance of Kabbalah, which led to a significant decline in Talmud status over the next centuries, that is, in the early modern period, its institutional foundations, that is, the rabbinate and the yeshiva, remained unchallenged. Notably, the only recorded attempt to establish a Kabbalah-oriented yeshiva came in the mid-17th century from Yaakov Tzemach, and even that remained an isolated proposition. So, on the conclusion of the early modern period, did Kabbalah serve as the foundation of institutionalizing a new type of religious leader, the tzaddik, accompanied by a decline in Talmudic scholarship as the primary basis for religious authority, as Ezekiel Punnett's letter so vividly illustrated. But this development presents a paradox. It was only with the decline of the Kabbalah Silvitic significance in the modern era that its unintended byproduct, the tzaddik, emerged as an unprecedented annals of Ashkenazi Jewry, an unprecedented institutional innovation. In a striking reversal, the tzaddik ultimately supplanted the very religious forces, that is the Kabbalah, that had been given rise to. It became now the salvific bridge. While this charismatic leader may not have been entirely unknown in the early modern era, its institutionalization was. The mediating role of the tzaddik, unprecedented in rabbinic Judaism, became a new transcendental bridge replacing the sociological function previously accorded to the study of the Kabbalah. The Hasid no longer needed to immerse himself in esoteric lore. Devotion to the tzaddik as a mediator was deemed sufficient. Exception to this trend included the tzaddikim of Zidichov and Komarno, who promoted intensive Kabbalistic curriculum, beginning even with children at the age of 8. But this was so unusual that it was dismissed. This shift also marked the transformation in the balance of power between religious and lay leadership, favoring the former at the expense of the other. Meanwhile, the traditional rabbinic establishment also saw its status further diminished by the rise of the charismatic dynasties. This transformation in leadership patterns marks a clear departure from the early modern era and reinforces Jacob Katz's argument in Tradition and Crisis that charisma, just as much as the Weberian ideal types of authority rooted in reason, could serve as an expression of modernity. That is, the tzaddik is actually, it's actually an expression of modernity rather than the early modern period, replacing earlier forms of traditional leadership. What I would add is that this shift also signaled a sociological departure not only from Talmudic study, but from Kabbalistic study as well. Notably, this was a distinctly internal development within Judaism with no discernible external influences. I don't see any other type of charismatic dynasties at that time from which they might have been. So the last part deals with Jewish languages, and I'll just start like this. Jews at the end of the medieval period in Spain and in Germany spoke Spanish and German. There might have been a slight tinge that would make them identify them as somehow Jewish. Maybe in the same way that in the 19th century, someone mauschelt, you understood that he had something Jewish, you know, the way he talked. Think of Woody Allen or Philip Roth. But basically, these were the two languages that Jews took with them when they were exiled from Spain and from the Germanies, going to Poland on the one hand and to the Ottoman Empire on the other hand. And what happened there was unique to the early modern period. You had the development of Jewish languages. It's not that they took Yiddish to Poland and they took Ladino to Ottoman Empire. No, they both places, Yiddish and Ladino, grew precisely in this sort of situation and precisely in the early modern period. And to a large extent, we can say that this is also the end of the era of early modern era, when you have the rise of the modern state that signals already the, at least the future fate of these Jewish languages. What is even more striking is not what happens in Poland and what happens in the Ottoman Empire. What is more striking is what happens in Germany itself. In Germany itself, Yiddish, Western Yiddish, develops over the 2-3 centuries until it becomes incomprehensible to local Germans. Jews might understand German, but on the other hand, it was very difficult for non-Jews to understand Yiddish, and you have these handbooks and various dictionaries teaching Yiddish to various people, and you should know you're in constantly in touch with Jews. They understand you, but you don't understand them, so you should really have some sort of basis of how to do it. So again, this is another phenomenon which in the early modern period does not create a situation of increasing convergence with a non-Jewish environment. On the contrary, it seems to be much more insular, much more diverging, and it's very much of an internal sort of development. And this is more or less, it marks again the early modern period and the novelty of these phenomena within the modern period. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this very, very stimulating paper, Mikael. Uh-huh. And I think we can start from this general idea of an early modern period that is composed by many islands, many insular experience in Judaism. I shall give the stage to Evelyn. Mm-hmm. First,
so much.
if you agree, Evelyn, just to remind us, is professor des universités at the Université Paris Cité.
Nobody knows what it is because it's changed names about 10 times in the past 5 years, but it used to be Jussieu, Paris 7, whatever year. Okay. Thank you.
She's a specialist on Jewish social religious history in Western Europe at the 18th century, and she works on circulation networks and dispute resolution in the Sephardic diaspora. Please.
Thank you. First of all, I'm very happy to be here today to honor Sylviane Bolberg, whom I have known for a long time. I hope she will forgive me for starting on a half-personal, half-academic note. I have here a very unique privilege because, and I think a privilege which few people can boast, I attended Sylviane's thesis defense one late afternoon. I think it was in 86, right, that's what I thought, in the Centre Châtelet, if you remember, there near the Rue Mouffetard, which is also part of the OHSS and where Sefren Yerushalmi used to have his classes. I was actually, and there really were not a lot of us. It was before the days when thesis defense became a big affair. It was a private gathering. And actually what happened is I was meeting with Gérard Naon, who was on the thesis committee, about a possible research topic. And he said, he suggested I arrive much earlier to hear this young woman presenting and defending her fascinating doctorate on Prague's funeral confraternities. And this is how we met. And I'm happy to recall that faraway memory today. Okay, Michael, you chose to focus on two phenomena, which you designated as eminently distinctive of what is usually called early modern times, and which you dubbed with a touch of Katzian, I would say, Pietism, almost, late medieval period, Kabbalah and Jewish languages. Please correct me if I am wrong in my exegesis of your presentation as it was sent to us. First, you decided to stray from the well-accepted, I could almost say canonized, pattern devised by David Ruderman of the five markers of Jewish early modernity, and to offer two more markers or angles, although it could be argued that the spread of Kabbalah in every single aspect of Jewish life is to a large extent a byproduct of mobility and of the revolution of print, and the same could be said about Jewish languages. in that sense, your proposition does not really invalidate David Ruderman's position, but rather adds a new focus that sort of reshuffles the markers with an internal perspective. Second, by choosing two homegrown phenomena, Kabbalah and Jewish languages, you wrote a paper that is a true tribute on several levels to Sylvia's work. First, as a reflection on a native Jewish temporality, and second, by choosing a marker, Kabbalah, which clearly articulates plural temporalities and is rooted in this world, as well as turned towards otherworldliness. A great example bringing together this proposition of a focus on Kabbalah and of a new elaboration on Jewish temporality could have been the emergence of the well-known ritual of the Seder of Tu Bishvat, which is first documented sometimes around the first half of the 18th century in the writings of Moshe Chagiz and in a book published in Izmir in 1731, Chemdat Yamim, as has been shown by the research of Boaz Hus. And so what used to be in Talmudic literature, a sort of tax deadline for tithing a new produce, assumed a new significance firmly rooted in Kabbalah, more Cordovero and Chaim Vital than Luria, as Boaz Hus has shown, and also in Sabbatianism, and subsequently became a significant date in the Jewish calendar and a ritual embraced by both Sephardic and Eastern European Jews. I think this example could have illustrated your idea about Kabbalah and also brings together the overlapping, plural, evolving Jewish temporalities which are at the heart of Sylvian's work and Klebsit in particular. Michael, by engaging, engaging, as you call it, in this thought experiment of focusing on Kabbalah and Jewish languages as two Jewish novel phenomena, you are somehow continuing a historical conversation on periodization that was started a long time ago, and which a good part of it was first retraced and presented in Michael Meyer's classical article, Where Does the Modern Jewish History Begin?, published in 1975, in which he goes back all the way to Isaac Marcus Yost, to Baron and Dinu, and concludes with a bit of methodological despair that no starting point or event seems relevant or convincing enough, and that historians should instead focus on the process of modernization. The conversation and attempts at periodization was continued by Jonathan Israel in his well-known book published in 1985 and largely revisited several times by David Ruderman before and after the publication of his Early Modern Jewry in 2010 by proposing the five markers of Jewish modernity, which I will not list because you mentioned that. I don't intend to go back into that whole conversation, but I think I'd rather want to organize these various phenomena or markers or events proposed throughout that conversation along the major divide between propositions that lie between propositions in the fact that while most authors chose external events or phenomena with a major impact on the Jews, such as the Reformation, the Cossacks massacres, the advent of Frederick the Great in Prussia, or the French Revolution, others focused on more internal phenomena or events, such as Sabbatai Tzvi, the emigration to the Holy Land of Rabbi Yehuda HaSid in 1700. So external, internal. While David Ruderman admired Jonathan Israel's endeavor, he joined the critics, emphasizing that Israel had mostly read the dynamics at work in the early modern Jewish world as being derivative from major religious or economic processes of European history. By choosing Kabbalah and Jewish languages, Michael adds to that conversation by designating the utmost internal and the least derivative markers possible, or so it seems, which are nevertheless at the heart of Jewish intellectual, cultural, spiritual, and ritual history. I would like to formulate here a few remarks about these markers, which you characterize as insular phenomena, as opposed to phenomena showing a growing closeness to non-Jewish environment, to quote your words. First, I'm not sure that the insularity stands scrutiny. I mean, I'm certainly not a specialist of Kabbalah, but it could be argued that Kabbalah is, on the contrary, a major area of contacts, exchanges, closeness, confrontation between Jews and Christians, whether in Italy, in the Holy Roman Empire, or later in England, from the 15th to the 18th century. As for Jewish languages, to a certain extent, they foster insularity, yes, but they grow from mobility and linguistic borrowings and fusion. And maybe that statement about Jewish languages and insularity is mostly valid for Yiddish-speaking areas and maybe Ottoman cities, but I don't think for Italy or even Western Europe, at least the Western Sephardi diaspora. Second, I think I'm convinced that the period we are talking about, I stand convinced, I don't say anything, I stand convinced that the period we are talking about, whether you call it late medieval or early modern, is not about insularity. Or if it is, it is a form of insularity that goes together with heightened exchange, with interaction, with porosity of the ghetto walls, as you remember, states it, and porosity of fences, that internal and external phenomena cannot be so easily isolated. The period markers of early modern Jewish times stand somewhere between the derivative and the insular patterns in a process of co-construction that is so well embodied by the topic of Jewish confraternities that is so dear to Sylvia. Finally, I would like to pursue your inclusion of Caro in this thought experiment and delineate another angle, take it in a slightly different direction, and maybe what could be maybe yet another marker of early modern Jewish times, that we combine both the internal and external and transactional perspective, and that would go across also the five markets of the Budomans, that is Jewish law and legal culture. In an article published in 2020 in Modern Intellectual History, entitled Jewish Modern Law and Legalism in a Global Age, the case of Rabbi Yosef Caro, Roni Weinstein has emphasized that the changes that emerged in the arena of Jewish law and its concept of legality were undeniably at the forefront of the passage to modernity. So he shows that Caro's process of codification, as singular as it is in phase with early modern legal major processes, both in Western Europe and in the Ottoman Empire. And as you say, in your text that the debate of codification is far from being novel. It goes back to Rambam or even to the Mishnah even. But it's taken here on another level because of the print revolution. In the early modern debate between the traditional approach of discussing Jewish law from the Talmudic sugya to modern commentators, exemplified, for instance, by Luria's Yamshel Shlomo, and the debate between that and Caro's rule-based codification, the former one loses because it's far less user-friendly and also doesn't get printed, the Yamshel Shlomo. Ted Fromm has shown that clearly, it has shown that in his book very clearly on the codification of Jewish law. The tension in the process of halachic production between code and commentary endures, but it is fundamentally transformed, crystallized, by which commentators of the Shulchan Aruch get to be on the printed page or not. So I just want to take this one step further to complete this, not the marker, but like this idea. I think halacha, Jewish law, and legal culture could be a major marker of early modernity, not only because of the fact that this process of codification finds its place in a new connected world, but also because of a mutual process of legal embeddedness or legal acculturation, as Jeb Berkowitz has called it in Metz, and which I also find in Livorno and Amsterdam, France, the idea that Jewish law becomes one of the specific bodies of law on which local courts rule, or at least which they consider, and Jewish legal and judicial culture and practice incorporates in turn many aspects of local legal cultures and practices. And I would say this is also somewhat distinctive of the early modern era, because it really comes to an end with the emergence of national legal codification starting in the early 19th century, which make this embeddedness of Jewish law essentially obsolete. So maybe we could add halacha and legal cultures as a co-construct to the expanding list of markers of early modernity. Or maybe we should just give up on that list and simply admit, together with Randolph Stern, who's quoted in one of Ruderman's articles, that, quote, of a quote, early, partly, sometimes, maybe modern, early modern is a period for our period's discomfort with periodization.
Beati? Yeah.
Do you want to say something?
Yeah, I want to say something.
Yeah, sure.
You can realize. Thank you very much, Evelyn. You said a lot of things that I wanted also to say, but I try not to repeat the same thing. But of course, the discussion around the fundamental work of David Ruderman is part of our daily work. And we are talking about early modern Jewry, a cultural history in published first in 2010. That is a work mostly focused on Sephardic and Mediterranean Jewry, mostly. And there is a chapter that is very important for all this discussion that is focused on the crisis of religious authority during the early modern, as a marker of the early modern period for Judaism. And you know, what you propose now in your paper is to sort of integrate a different, mostly Ashkenazi way to modernity, to early modernity, to be considered as manifesting under different foundation, under different temporalities, and you is a step that, of course, necessary, very stimulating, that you lead us to learn about different spaces and experience in Jewry and discourses from those already known and discussed. So the focus, if I'm not wrong, is most not on integration, but in internal, autonomous development within Jewry, Judaism. And it's really, really stimulating. I should focus my first question on the place of Kabbalah, because your paper was very focused on this. And I was thinking about, always thinking of the perspective of the, David Ruderman about Hebrew printing. That is another common feature of early modern Jewry. And early modern Jewry is often presented through the history of printing. In 16th century Italy, the printing of Hebrew Bible with a Rashi commentary of the Babylonian Talmud and of the Zohar, the Sefer HaZohar, are almost concomitant event. As to tell, they were felt as among the most important books of Jewish culture, sharing an almost equal place within the Jewish religious corpus, as they were complementary texts. How do you explain this? Do this represent a different layer, a different process, a different stage in Jewish experience of the early modernity? How do you make the link to what you say, the concern mostly Ashkenazi area, to what happens in Italy and in the Sephardic diaspora more broadly?
Okay, so let's just, now I respond to what.
Yeah.
I chose just two phenomenon because everyone is doing the other stuff. So what I did is you're downplaying the whole thing of languages. I'm sorry. If I were to write something on early modern period, I would say something about that. I would say, these are the centuries when you have the Jewish languages emerging. That's it. You don't have to do more than that. But if you say that, you say, these are the times when language, when Jews are getting further apart from their non-Jewish environments. I think that's quite simple. And then on a most basic sort of level, It might be that on the very top you have all these engagements. It might be that on the very top you have Christian Kabbalists reading the Kabbalah. And by the way, that's a phenomenon that doesn't last more than the 1720s, 1730s, like almost everything that Rudiman brings there. Mingled identities that Rudiman brings, it's all over by 1730s or something like that. I mean, and certainly by once you have the Francists, and it's finished. The Sabbatianism is finished as well. A lot of the stuff that he says that it doesn't, he talks, I think, quite correctly about the early modern period. He's not talking about modern period. He's talking about the early modern period as these are the characteristics. And in that, he's quite correct. That's what, and I think that's important. And once again, this, what I was talking about is something that does not lead to the modern period. On the contrary, something that is stuck in the early modern period, something that defines the modern early period. And I think that's what I said. What you said about codification, of course, I didn't say that the entire early modern period is insular and looking inside or whatever. No, of course, there are all sorts of influences coming from outside. What I was saying about Kabbalah was something very specific. What I was saying is about the soteriological function of knowledge. That's not popularization of Kabbalah. It's not codification. It's what codification and Kabbalah does in terms of attacking what was perceived until that time as the golden path to salvation, which was via Talmudic study. And that's what happens in the beginning of the early modern period. That's what defines this period. You didn't have this in the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, you had philosophy attacking the Talmud for around 2-3 centuries, and then it was finished. And Kabbalah didn't do that yet. What is striking about the early modern period is the rise of the Kabbalah as an alternate, not alternate, as the means of salvation. And I think that's a very internal sort of, something is happening in the Christian world as well about seeking salvation, especially when you start having the confessionalization, when you start having the different Protestant religions. But this is something that is very, very much Jewish, very much what happens in terms of that. So when I was talking about codification, I meant. Codification usually means a downplaying of Talmud. It usually means don't bother. Here it is. Here's the bottom line. You can go on and do this type of thing. And it almost always happens. And you can see this throughout the medieval period. People prefer Al-Fasi. People prefer Mishnah Torah. People prefer the Torah each time. And the same thing happens with the Shulchan Aruch. We know already. Come on, let's get on to something really important. This is what Maimonides said. So that's one thing. And I think about the languages, what I said is, I think it's self-understood. Now about Portuguese and Italians, certainly in terms of, demography, we're talking about 30,000, I think, in Italy, and maybe 20,000 in the Western Sephardi diaspora. But even there you have, I think, that the Italian, well, in Italy you can't speak Italian. You each time are speaking very local sort of dialects to begin with. And I'm sure that there is an Italian, Judeo-Italian, which is slightly different. I don't think it makes the same sort of insularity that I think that Yiddish and Ladino does. But yeah, you're right. In those cases, you don't have that. As far as the Portuguese the Netherlands, I don't know when they stopped speaking Portuguese. Probably around the middle of the 18th century, they already stopped speaking it, even though they're still writing it, and their Pincasim, it's in Portuguese, I think, for another few decades. Am I right? So you don't have that. Then you're right. It's very different in those cases. But those are very few. We're talking about very few people. But I can still talk about, let's say, religious laxity. We tend to see religious laxity in Amsterdam. But we know that by the middle of the 18th century, what happens in the Sephardi communities, the Portuguese communities in the West, is that there's a sort of a bifurcation. Almost all the, at least the ones that I've seen in London, all the Portuguese families by around the last decades of the 18th century have either totally converted to Christianity or they've become nicely Orthodox. That's about it. All of that that exuberant type of intellectual ferment that you had in the 17th century, nothing. I mean, the last of the any thinkers in Amsterdam is, I think, De Pinto. That's more or less, it's sort of an epigon to the whole situation. So the whole thing is much more, it's actually an end of an era, if you want to say, you know, this type of thing. So they seem to have exhausted themselves. As far as the Italians, the same thing goes. I think Lois Dubin has shown very nicely that at the very beginning of the Haskalah, people look to Trieste the way they look toward Amsterdam. By the early part of the 19th century, you know, Trieste has become, and Italian Jewry have become very orthodox, have become the whole, whatever what's seen as somehow linked to more modern trends has dissipated. And whatever you have that has become sort of, nevertheless, let's say in England, or a reform movement, well, that's basically copied over from the Ashkenazim. So Todd Endelman's idea of things just happening, of a sort of a dissipating tradition. Well, what happens is that you can't keep that up too long and remain Jewish. What happens is that you have to give it some sort of a meaning, some sort of an ideological background, and that's what happens. Ultimately, they all end up in synagogues that are basically modeled either on the German, probably on the German pattern in both cases. I mean, that's what I, you know, that says. It's very difficult to have just people, you know, go around shaving their beards without noticing that they're doing it. You know, there is a meaning to what you're doing, maybe an issue. So anyway, so that's the type of thing. But otherwise, I take it a lot of things that you said. Sure. Why not? Okay.